I'm Poppy Tooker, and I've got the most exciting good news about Louisiana Eats. Louisiana Eats has received a Taste Award nomination in three categories: Best Food Program, Best Food Broadcast, and Best Food Podcast. It's a Listener's Choice Award, so it's up to you to please give us your vote. Just go to poppytooker.com, where you can click straight through to the voting for the 8th Annual Taste Awards. Voting ends on December the 20th, so don't wait, vote now. Thanks for your vote, and thanks for listening. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. And by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. In the 21st century, many chefs are considered to be superstars, comparable to celebrities of stage and screen. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we're getting personal with some of my favorite superstars. James Beard Award-winning Chicago chef Rick Bayless is the owner of several authentic yet trend-setting Mexican restaurants and hosts his own public television series, Mexico, One Plate at a Time. Despite all the success and accolades, Rick is a very humble man. We'll hear his story, and then our next James Beard Award winner steps up to the plate, executive chef Tori McPhail of Commander's Palace fame. Finally, we'll catch up with Chef Bingo Starr, who explains why he left a superstar career in New Orleans for a quieter life in Natchez, Mississippi. We've got a full plate of the greatest of the greats on this week's Louisiana Eats. The legendary Julia Child once said, "Find something you're passionate about and keep tremendously interested in it." When Chef Rick Bayless earned the Julia Child Award this year for his transformative Mexican cuisine, he brought Julia's idea to life. Rick is the James Beard Award-winning chef and owner of several authentic yet trend-setting Mexican restaurants in Chicago and hosts his own public television series, Mexico, One Plate at a Time. Despite all of these accomplishments, Rick approaches cooking with remarkable humility, something that was clearly evident during his visit to our studio.
Julia Child came on television when I was 10, and she changed my life. Because even as a 10-year-old that was really interested in food and cooking, which was kind of unusual back then because we didn't have the Food Network to sort of goad us along, I fell in love with the ideas that she presented. She was just such an amazing teacher, and she would talk about where you would eat these different dishes in France and how they were prepared and the care that went into all of their preparation. And for me, that was a really eye-opening experience. So I spent a lot of time in my home kitchen mastering the art of French cooking, as Julia's first book was called. I actually got that book when I was 12. That's another really long story, is how a 12-year-old comes up on a big tome like that. But I cooked all the way through it. I made all those dishes that were in it. And then when I was 13, I came to New Orleans and had those wonderful experiences here in the restaurants, and that was so different than what we had in Oklahoma City. And so I was able to put it all together, and I figured that I was probably going to really focus on French cooking because I was just in love with the refinement of it, the traditions of it, the variety that you could find there. And then the next year, I had the opportunity to go to Mexico City. And that changed my life because I didn't fall in love with the food first. I fell in love with the culture and the generosity of spirit. And I tell you, when I got off of the plane, I was there about an hour, and I felt like I'd come home, that something about that culture was just perfect for me, and sort of settled into going back every year, then majored in Spanish language, literature, and Latin American studies, and then the rest is kind of history. I moved there for a long time, decided to put my love for food together with my love for Mexican culture, and wrote my first book. And then after 5 years, moved back to the States and opened our first restaurant, Frontera Grill, which is now turning 30 years old. So I'm
unbelievable.
Up on the tails of what my parents did with their restaurant for 37 years.
Incredible. And to have this complete circle, I cannot imagine the incredible, humbling, overwhelming honor it must have been when you discovered that they were going to award you the Julia Child Award.
I kind of sat down and cried because it was one of those things that was full circle. If it weren't for Julia opening my eyes to the possibilities of the food world, I wouldn't be where I am now. And she's the one that sort of goaded me on, not knowing that she was personally doing it, but just having those books out there and having those television shows out there, she really changed my life. And so when they called me to tell me that they were going to give me this award, and I was on her last television series, which was called Julia Cooks with the Master Chefs. And from those early days of working with her books and everything, I had memorized. She did a book called From Julia's Kitchen, and it had a diagram of her kitchen and all the parts of it and those pegboards that her husband had put up on the wall so that all of her equipment was out there. And I had just memorized all of that stuff. And every apartment that I lived in after I left my family home, I put a pegboard on the wall and I hung my stuff up there. And I got to walk into that kitchen there in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was blown away because it was like I knew the thing really well, and yet I had never been there. And I got to cook with Julia on the show, and then got to have dinner around her dining room table that evening, and then go out with her. It was her 83rd birthday the next day, and we shot the shows the next day, and we went out to dinner, a whole big bunch of us. And at 11 o'clock, I was just shot. I mean, I was like, I had worked so hard all day long, and Julia was still going. And I thought to myself, this is the person I want to be when I'm 83 years old.
So explain for people who may not know what comes with receiving the Julia Child Award.
It's a really wonderful thing. First of all, it's part of the Smithsonian, and the organization is what they're really looking for is people who have made a big impact in the way that people eat and drink in the United States. And I've plodded along for all these years, opening people's eyes, I hope, to the riches of Mexican food and its culture. And I've done a lot of it through teaching, especially on my television show, and a lot of writing. And then, of course, actually backing it up with restaurants that serve this kind of food, because we don't know very much about it, still don't know that much about it in the United States, so we're getting a lot better. And when they picked me to do that, they announced that it was going to be a $50,000 prize to go to the charity of my choice. And my charity is the Frontera Farmer Foundation, which is a not-for-profit that we started about 12 years ago to support local agriculture. Because what I had learned in Mexico was that the best food comes from the places that have the best local agriculture. And we were really not doing well in Chicago 30 years ago when I set up shop there. We didn't have a single farmer's market. I couldn't find a single local farm to buy from. I could drive for an hour and a half outside the city and buy stuff from a farm stand, but that wasn't very sustainable. And then over the 30 years, we have changed really drastically, and a lot because we have helped to invest in these farms. So we invest small, they're really small grants, usually $10,000 to $12,000, to help people buy a tractor, a watering system, a new hoop house, whatever they say that they need to make themselves more productive and profitable, that's what we will invest in. And we've given away about $1.5 million in these small grants, and it's really made a big difference. Now we have like 40-some farmers markets in Chicago and a really thriving chef community that buys from the local farms.
It's really exciting. And what an honor that some of your personal things are going to the Smithsonian also.
That's crazy. I don't understand it. I'm working on all that stuff now, and I think, why would anybody want any of this stuff? So I've been trying to think of it from the outside. Like, what would I want to see of Julia's? And I know what I wanted to see of Julia's because she wrote about those things. And I thought it would, I'll look at it from that angle. I'm still putting stuff together, but yeah, they are going to take some of my stuff, my old pack rat stuff, and put it in the Smithsonian.
Well, bravo, bravo. And to me, the most amazing and inspirational part is your tortilla program.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you and I share a great love for preserving biodiversity, right. And you have taken this now to an amazing extreme.
Well, so we buy mostly, like all of our proteins are all locally raised around Chicago. Of course, we'll put some fish from the two coasts on the menu. We don't only work with lake fish that come from around us. This corn program, well, a lot of people don't even understand, don't even know this, that a whole lot of the corn that is made into this masa flour by a big company called Maseca in Mexico is grown in the Midwest. And the second largest Maseca plant in the world is just south of Chicago. And they are growing all this Midwest corn, and it's all GMO corn. And then they're making this Maseca out of it and then shipping it back to Mexico. And it is engineered to be as flavorless as possible so that no matter what region of Mexico you are in, it's not competing with your local stuff. It's just a blank slate. And now people have gotten so used to that, they've almost forgotten what really good regional varieties of heirloom corn taste like. So to counteract that, we decided we were going to work with a group called Macienda, and we were going to bring in truckloads and truckloads of corn that is grown by small family farms in Oaxaca and have that made into our masa every day, our fresh masa, by a tortilleria in Chicago that does all non-GMO corn anyway. And the first day, this is a real telling thing. It was like every single person on our staff that grew up in Mexico had to stop and just smell it. And it was like you could tell that they were a million miles away, back in time to their childhood when they were maybe at their grandmother's house and back when the corn was still really good in Mexico. And they would smell it and they would go, oh, this is like my childhood. This is like all the memories that are flooding into my head just smelling this corn. It is so delicious.
That in itself, you know, to have that experience of bringing back life-changing memories, mm-hmm. bringing back, because there's nothing more evocative than the sense of scent, and then, of course, taste.
Oh, completely, completely.
I mean, it just brings you back. It's attached to your heartstrings, and you must have wanted to cry that day, too.
It was incredibly rewarding because I have spent a lot of time. I lived in Oaxaca for a while, and I knew what that flavor was like, and I loved the tortillas that we hand-pressed and made for all of these years in our restaurant. In fact, the reason we settled in Chicago is that there's such great availability of masa, fresh ground masa in Chicago. And I built our restaurant on these hand-pressed tortillas that are always taken from the griddle straight to your table. Those are what, to me, are the foundation of all flavor. If you eat that tortilla alongside a super flavorful mole, say, they're balancing each other because the simplicity of the flavor in the tortilla balances so beautifully against the complexity of that mole. And it's the balance that's happened and been created over many centuries. And I respect that.
Well, you are just like meeting a live wire in person. I mean, my goodness, there's the restaurants. But your PBS television show is going into its 11th season?
11th season, if you can imagine. Yes, we just finished it.
How do you keep creating?
You know, I'm incredibly curious, that's all. I will say that a lot of it just has to do with curiosity. As I was walking around, I mean, here we are in the middle of the French Quarter. Even though there's all these touristy shops, I found myself wandering into some of them and looking at some of the ingredients and wondering what's the history of this thing that they're selling here. And I'm just really interested in digging below the surface and finding all the riches, because I love the human race. We make things beautiful. We don't have to. You know, we could nourish ourselves on unseasoned gruel. Okay, we could. We don't have to make beautifully presented food. We don't have to make delicious food. We don't have to make beautiful clothing and gorgeous architecture. We do that because in our souls we want the joy of seeing beauty. And I'm one of those people that just loves to explore what people have done that's really beautiful. And I respect it and I love it, and I am infinitely curious to what leads people to create this beauty when they don't have to. I mean, we could all be sitting in front of the TV with our feet up and doing nothing, but instead we choose to tackle these projects because we create beauty in the world.
Chef Rick Bayless of Chicago's Frontera Restaurant. When we come back from a short break, our next chef, Tori McPhail of Commander's Palace, will join us. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally slow roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold.
My name's Tori McPhail, and I'm the executive chef of Commander's Palace.
It's no secret that the kitchen at Commander's Palace has a long, celebrated history of cultivating such revered chefs as Emeril Lagasse, Paul Prudhomme, and Jamie Shannon. It's a tough act to follow. But through determination and dedication to his craft, Tori McPhail has secured his place as part of Commander's legacy. We spoke to the James Beard Award-winning chef about his career, his relationship with Chef Jamie Shannon, and how he came to be such an important part of the Commander's Palace family.
You know, even though I've been there for as long as I have, I still get goosebumps walking up to the front door, you know, because you park your car and then you walk down the side of this old historic cemetery and you see the old oak trees and a quiet neighborhood, and you know you're in New Orleans, and all of a sudden you come around that old familiar bend and you see this gorgeous blue and white Victorian mansion, and all of a sudden the hair on the back of your neck stands up. You start to get goosebumps. You're like, oh my God, I mean, this is Commander's. I mean, it's such a legendary place, and it means so much to everybody, but to every single New Orleanian. I mean, how many special occasions do you share at Commander's? You know, how many of grandma's birthdays or little Johnny's soccer games? So for me to be there as long as I have and to follow in the footsteps of Paul Prudhomme, right, amazing legend, our friend Emeril Lagasse, and Jamie Shannon, man, I don't think there's anything better. I honestly have the coolest job on the planet to be able to guide a ship like that to stardom. I have maybe more of a little unusual story than probably the typical New Orleans chef, being that, number one, I'm not from here. I'm not even from this half of the United States. I grew up in a tiny little farming town in Washington State. So for me growing up, it was all about agriculture, picking 4 ears of corn or digging 4 potatoes or doing what we had to do. So I went through culinary school after leaving my uncle's raspberry farm and moving down to Seattle when I was just 17, and went through culinary school there. And I took some really good advice leaving culinary school. They said, look, man, if you really want to be a great chef, you either move to New York City, but if you want to understand cooking and food and cuisine and flavor, then you move to New Orleans. And if you're lucky enough to get an interview, try to go to Commander's Palace and see Jamie Shannon. And so I did that. I was 19 years old and got an interview and aced my test. And then Jamie hired me to start working in the Garmager. And that's been 23 years ago.
You weren't there working with either Paul Prudhomme or Emeril.
Right.
Because I know you have a relationship with them. So, or at least in God Bless Paul did. But tell me about what that was like to get to know these guys.
I guess going back through my career, I mean, I started understanding who Emeril was in my early years here in New Orleans, but didn't have the opportunity to really meet him until probably maybe like the earlier mid-90s. Emeril was the best man at Jamie's wedding. And so we always had this connection to Commander's, plus all of his buddies were there. So Emeril started coming in and I was, you know, starstruck because you can see him on Food Network and, you know, see posters. He's got his restaurants all over the place. And then Paul kind of at the same time. And Paul always used to be so nice and so gracious to every single person, every walk of life. But to start to get know the guys more and more, I started climbing through the Commander's ladder. And it didn't matter where we were. If I was meeting Paul in Chicago, if I was seeing Emeril in Miami, they would always stop and say, hey, Tori, how are you? How's Jamie? How's Ella? How's T and Lally, the rest of the gang? And then as the years progressed, you know, things started happening with Jamie. And so even now, when I see Emeril, he's kind of like a big brother. You know what I mean? He's kind of like that favorite uncle you've always kind of had and a guy that I will always look up to.
Well, I heard the hesitation in your voice, and this is something that we've discussed with T, and it's a really difficult subject matter to even touch on for any of us who knew him and were involved in the New Orleans food scene during Jamie Shannon's incredible tenure at Commander's Palace. And I think that there's a lot of people who think they're food savvy who might not even recognize his name, sadly, because although he and T published a cookbook and he was such a larger-than-life presence, he died when he was 40. Right. He never had the opportunity to become a Food Network star or open his own restaurant. Commander's was his life, and sadly, when he lost his life, that was his last spot.
Yeah. You know, Commander's was huge for Jamie, and I kind of felt like the names were kind of synonymous with fantastic cooking. He's been gone now for about 14 years, and you know, for me as a kid, I mean, he was the guy you saw 5 and 6 days a week. Big guy, he was like 6'3", probably 225, literally larger than life. Then when he puts on the crisp chef's jacket and a long white apron and then puts another foot of chef's hat on top of that, the guy comes walking in and there is no question who the chef of that restaurant is. And at that time, you know, Emeril was really doing his thing and Frank Brightson and Susan Spicer and a lot of other chefs are starting to make their way up. But he was, you know, kind of like the crown of New Orleans at that time for New World Creole food.
I love the way you describe him. And you left out, of course, two of the most amusing parts, which would certainly give someone a little bit of a pause. You know, there was the long blonde ponytail.
True.
And then there was the Harley Davidson.
That's true. And in the conversation, you can't leave out the 1980-something convertible red BMW that was unmistakably Jamie. And I got to tell you, man, there's probably things I can't say on the radio, but as young cooks coming up through the ranks, I mean, that guy on a Saturday night would hold court in any other magazine little drinking establishment. And that was it. You know, the guy walks into, you know, even the bar like the Le Bon Ton Roulet. Well, that was kind of like our clubhouse. And it was Jamie's clubhouse. And it wasn't just the Commander's folks. It was, you know, everybody from all of Uptown. You know, walk into Le Bon Ton, which was the place to be. And there you see Jamie's BMW parked in the front, top down. And it was wild. I love the guy on, for so many reasons, in the restaurant and out of the restaurant. He was just a great mentor and such a good, he's kind of like a player's coach. You know what I mean? like somebody that everybody could look up to. Yeah, he was probably sick for maybe longer than any of us knew about, longer than he would tell anybody. And he started, just kind of walking with a bit of a limp, and he's like, yeah, I used to play hockey growing up in Jersey. And it was just kind of one of those things. It's like, yeah, my hip kind of hurts. And it just kind of went on, and I finally got the whole thing checked out, and then ended up that he had cancer. I was in Las Vegas at the time, and it was tough. When he calls you and says, hey, look, I got cancer. This is the deal. They amputated my leg. I mean, how can you not just like crying on the telephone? I mean, that's your mentor. That's the guy. That's the guy you've always looked up to, is, being 2,000 miles away from home, and that's family. You know what I mean? So to take that call and have that conversation and have him say, hey, man, come back to New Orleans, come back to the Commanders team. I want you to be my eyes and ears and my legs so we can continue to push Commanders forward. I mean, that just, goes right to your heart. It's a tough telephone call, tough day.
And the other thing that has to have been really tough for you is that in the meantime, you are actually the acting executive chef, mm-hmm. because he's sick, he can't be there. Somebody's got to be in charge of that enormous operation.
Yeah.
And what was that climate like?
It's a difficult time. When I first got back, we had the deal worked out where I was going to move back to New Orleans. And so it was the day after Thanksgiving. I think it was November 26th at about 11:15 in the morning. I was serving family meal to all the rest of the staff. I put on my chef whites for the very first time. It says Commander's Palace, Las Vegas, Executive Sous Chef Tori McPhail. And so I slip on the whites, put on my chef's hat, put on my apron, and I'm bouncing around the kitchen for like an hour, introducing myself to new cooks, new sous chefs, reintroducing myself with old friends that I'd worked with for over a long, long time. And on my very first day back, he passed away. And we always knew things were close, but certainly towards the end, things slipped down the slope pretty quickly. But to have that happen, I could just see T's face, Lally's face, walking through the patio, and I'm making eye contact with them. They're looking at me, and I get to see their face, and I just knew. And there was just this lull over Commanders, this kind of dark cloud for so long, mm-hmm. that it's tough to say, hey, look, I'm going to help run the show, but I wasn't Jamie. I was never going to be Jamie. He was always the chef of the restaurant. And so it was a tough patch for probably like 4 months, pushing forward and saying, hey, look, we're not rushing to do anything. I just want to live up to his legacy and keep pushing forward just like he would have.
Tell me about you and Ella. When I interviewed her not so long ago, she said the number one overriding element that was the continuous thread from Paul all the way to you is that you've got magic in your hands. Mm. So when did she first tell you that?
I imagine at some point after I became chef, we had a lot of great conversations. We ate a lot of good food together. But I think being the chef at Commander's Palace or any great organization has, certainly you need to be a fantastic cook. You need to understand flavor. You need to be a good historian of Louisiana food. But you got to be a good friend. You got to be a good listener. You got to be a good mentor. You have to be a good role model. You need to know how to take a kid from the neighborhood and teach him how to be more than he probably thinks he's capable of. Really understand, hey, look, here, this is where you're at, but this is, you follow this path and you give the guy goals and help shape that. Greatness can come from people who may not know that they have it in them. And I think that's one of the things Ella's always been great at, whether it happens to be Paul or Emeril or Jamie. She's allowed us to make mistakes, but kind of reveal more of our character through hard work and dedication every day and her guidance.
What do you want your legacy at Commander's Palace to be?
So I think for me, following the footsteps of all the great, great guys, I guess at the end of the day, if more people can say, hey, you know what, Tori McPhail taught me more about cooking and more about restaurants, but really more about how to be a really good guy, I think that's probably better than any kind of paycheck I would ever earn. Certainly I've helped push Commanders forward, and I'm the longest sitting chef they've ever had and worked there longer than anybody else. but really to leave a lasting and indelible mark on the community and helping to inspire and change the lives of everybody who's always worked under me. I mean, I think that would be the lasting legacy of my career at Commanders.
Tori McPhail, executive chef of Commander's Palace. While Chef Tori McPhail's career may have led him to find a new home in the Pelican State, in Natchez, Mississippi, there's a chef whose career led him to relocate from his Louisiana home.
My name's Chef Bingo Starr, also known as Richard Starr, and I'm the chef partner at the Carriage House Restaurant in Natchez, Mississippi.
Chef Bingo's career in cuisine began in New Orleans, where in the 1990s he worked as a chef at the Windsor Court Hotel and Delmonico's. In 2000, Bingo became chef at Cuvée in the Warehouse District, where he worked until Hurricane Katrina. On a recent trip to Natchez, the Louisiana Eats crew sat down with Chef Bingo to hear about his move to Mississippi and to find out what it's like becoming the new chef in one of the city's oldest and most revered dining institutions.
I married a girl from New Zealand, and about a month before Katrina, we got married, and then we moved over to New Zealand and stayed there for about 2 years, and then came back to work with Jason Rowland, and we opened a catering company in St. Francisville and catered all over the South, and just missed the restaurant life, you know, just having the people in front of your face all the time. Started coming here for Natchez Food and Wine Festival with Regina Charbonneau, staying at her house, and just fell in love with the place. And then she invited me to lunch here one day because I expressed that I kind of wanted to get back in the restaurant business. Took me back in the kitchen. I met all the ladies that were, you know, cooking here for 40 years, and just felt like home, you know, like Bull's Corner, where I grew up cooking at my uncle's restaurant. It felt just like that. So I sat down, and she said, you know, what do you think about the place? I said, I love it. It needs a lot of help, but I like it. She goes, you want it? I said, okay, I'll take it. And that was it. That's been about 7-8 years ago. It was a tired, kind of old place, you know, and the business was going down. So I had to come in and kind of breathe some fresh air into it. A lot of people wanted to jump off the cliff. I was told I was ruining the place and this, you know, just making changes, you know.
Give me a specific.
They used to have a frozen fruit salad, which was like canned fruit salad whipped with cream cheese and horseradish and something else.
And you couldn't do that.
I couldn't do it. And, you know, that was like the biggest thing. I've learned to come and respect the tomato aspic. And never did I think I'd be making a living off of frying chicken and baby biscuits and tomato aspic. But, you know, we do a lot. I brought my touch in, and eventually I earned the trust of the locals. You know, we have a great Friday cheap cocktail lunch, kind of like a Galatoire's-esque kind of thing, where, you know, we have big tables, all the locals come in, and I do great seafood specials on that day. So I've gained the trust. It only took me 7-8 years to get.
Well, it's hard for an outsider to break into all this tradition.
Yes, yeah, it's only through my children, my younger children, that have we gotten in, you know, through sports and church and, you know, school and, you know, fundraising and all this stuff. That's how I got in, you know, it takes, you know, a small town is a very tight-knit community. Yeah.
Is there anything that you learned from some of the old ways?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I learned how to cook greens the proper way. You know, I learned how to make biscuits. I learned how to fry chicken the right way. Just cooking vegetables, you know. It doesn't start with anything but bacon or pork fat or whatever. And, yeah, and you got to have that layer of lard on top of the vegetables when they're sitting in the cooler. Like, it almost looks like a confit. I learned about spooning a, you know, tablespoon lard into vegetables, you know, make them shiny, as they say.
Isn't that something?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, real country cooking, yeah. I just try to, you know, kind of bring back old stuff. And the stuff, you know, I grew up cooking. And, I mean, chefs are the most sentimental people in the world, you know. And it's all about bringing back memories and feelings and, you know, of where you come from, you know. That's what does it for me.
Chef Bingo Starr of the Carriage House Restaurant in Natchez, Mississippi. Have Have you ever eaten tomato aspic? Do you even know what it is? Stay tuned, and we'll give you the full tomato aspic 411 when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, featuring Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine overlooking City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans, Mid-City. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is tomato aspic? Tomato aspic is the irreplaceable dish mentioned by Chef Bingo Starr that's a revered tradition at the Carriage House of Stanton Hall in Natchez, Mississippi. Aspics appeared on the tables of French royalty as early as the 15th century. It's a cold jelly dish, sometimes made with chilled bouillon, but most often held together today with Knox gelatin. Tomato aspic has long been a Southern staple, but really reached its heyday in the mid-1950s. My mother, who was certainly not much of a cook, served us tomato aspic out of a can, situated on a leaf of iceberg lettuce with a dollop of mayonnaise on top. At the time, I thought it was disgusting. Later in life, a dear friend taught me to make her mother's homemade tomato aspic, and I came to love the dish. With a really good, deeply tomato-flavored base, accented by green onions and a myriad of pretty veggies and cold chicken, Anne's tomato aspic made for a lovely summer dinner. But it's also just as nice on a Christmas table with its brilliant ruby-red color. For my tomato aspic recipe, visit our websites. It's neworleans.com, poppytooker.com, and wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and tomato aspic makes for some good Louisiana Eats. Being successful as a young chef, first-time restaurateur, is difficult at any age. But accomplishing it in New York's East Village before the age of 30 is especially difficult. Journalist Karen Stabiner's book, Generation Chef, gives us a behind-the-scenes look at the ups and downs Chef Jonah Miller endured while opening Huertas. We sat down with Karen to discuss the book and how she came to write it.
Well, I should say the stories that I like best always are the ones that read like novels, but they happen to be true. It's a really nice added level of tension, you know. It was a very simple thing. I was, in fact, working on a cookbook with a group of New York City restaurants that are sort of known for their family culture. And we did a cookbook about staff meals, which are the meals that cooks make for themselves and the rest of the staff before the customers come in. And I was hanging around in the kitchens, which is my favorite thing to do, and I noticed that almost everyone in the kitchen was maybe 22, 23, 24 years old. You know, it's a much more diverse kitchen than it used to be, which made it more interesting. It's not just a bunch of white guys anymore. And everybody had a dream, which boiled down to, I've got to have my own restaurant before I'm 30 or I'll never have one. And the writer in me thought, there's a lot of suspense and tension here. You know, these are really driven cooks. And cooks are like athletes. You know, they peak earlier than normal people. So they don't have much time to establish themselves. And I thought, if I can get one of these people to let me be a fly on the wall, I'm going to have a way into the whole current cooking scene, which has changed drastically in the last 10 years.
So how did you meet Jonah Miller, who is one of the main storylines in your book?
Right. I've lived in New York for about 8 years, and I know some people in the restaurant business because I write about food. And so I started doing research. I said, do you know somebody who's got a more than decent chance of making it? Because this book was as much a risk for me as it was for Jonah. I mean, if Jonah had gone out of business, I would not have had a book. So we were kind of in this together. And his name came up a couple of times. And honestly, I met with him knowing that it might not work out, and then I would go to the next name on the list. And I remember we sat in a park in New York, and there he is with his little backpack, you know, and he kept pulling pieces of paper out of the backpack. Here's my drawing for the dining room. Here's my design for the kitchen. Here's a sample menu I've come up with. Here's my business plan. And he was so passionate and so excited that to me it was a really clear thing. And I remember hoping, I hope he'll say yes. I hope he says yes. And he said yes just as quickly. So it sort of happened before I knew it.
So tell us about Jonah's dream restaurant that he made come true.
Okay. And I should say, Jonah started working in professional kitchens when he was 14 years old at a famous, a legendary New York restaurant called Chanterelle, whose owner had started it when he was 23. So he understood all about Jonah's dream. Jonah wanted to do it by the time he was 23 because things are more competitive now. It took him until he was just 26. It's a 65-seat Basque restaurant, a Spanish restaurant specializing in Basque food, which is a particular regional cuisine. It's in New York City's East Village, which is kind of a little restaurant row all of its own. And it's kind of a starter restaurant in the sense that every young chef with a dream here looks for a 25 by 80 foot storefront someplace where there's enough restaurant traffic that people will walk by, and opens on a shoestring, although a shoestring still means that the day he opened, he owed $700,000 to various people.
That's pretty terrifying.
You know, it's amazing to me that he managed to hold it together, but that qualifies as a shoestring. If it had been his perfect dream, it would have been $1 million.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's, as I said, a very small place, but it's the way that people here get their start. It's all they can afford. It was designed by a restaurant designer who basically bartered Jonah, said, I won't charge you my fee up front, but I want to design the restaurant of my dreams. So everybody here had a dream. And it's supposed to be the first step in something larger. Because the other thing that's different now, and I don't care where you are in the country, one restaurant is not really much security. Most people like Jonah want to hopscotch from 1 to 3 or to 5 or to a quick serve outlet that serves some version of what they serve in the sit-down restaurant. So this is just the beginning.
So Karen, you were there then literally from the time that this restaurant was a dream on a bunch of pieces of scrap paper in a backpack.
I was there from there through their second anniversary. I mean, I have seen Jonah doing very un-chef-like things because he was trying to save money. I saw him painting chairs. I saw him refinishing paneling. At one point, they set him up with a mask and gloves, and he was sitting at a huge tile cutter cutting the tiles for the kitchen because it was cheaper than buying custom sizes. I mean, that part of it went on forever. We went to the liquor license meeting together so that he could get turned down. You know, all sorts of stuff goes into it before it actually opens. I think we have a really wrong-headed notion of what it means to be a chef who owns his own restaurant. I mean, the first week that they were open, Jonah's like 6'2". First week they were open, on the final Saturday night of the week, so they were going to be closed on Sunday, I looked over at him, and I swear he looked like my grandfather used to look. You know, he was stretching his arms, and he was rolling his neck, and he was kneading his shoulders, and I said, he's 26. I said, Jonah, are you okay? And he said, I look like this at the end of every week. Thank God I'm having a massage tomorrow.
Oh, Lord. Well, that was really one of the very fascinating things, because there's also a lot of tension that goes on. Tension between, in particular, he and his working partners, Nate Adler and Luke Momo. So he had two front-of-the-house partners, and he was the chef. And I wondered, did it ever get awkward for you to be up in all that?
Oh, it's always awkward for somebody who's being a fly on the wall. And what you really try to do is just kind of melt into the furniture so that nobody really notices that you're there anymore. I mean, there was an argument among the three of them when they first opened, and it was, you know, it was an indication of how tough this business really is. All that happened was that a couple sort of got stranded at the bar where they were having drinks and some appetizers because one of the partners knew they had a reservation in the dining room. The dining room was full, and he didn't think to put them at another table so that they could start their dinner. And it's the kind of little thing that just triggered such anger in Jonah because he felt as though his whole life were in other people's hands, mm-hmm. you know? And I was standing right there in the kitchen, 2 feet away from the three of them, and it was an open kitchen, so everybody could hear, and they were having an argument. And one by one, they would sort of glance over to see what I was doing, you know? And I just kept writing because that's what the relationship is. And even though I felt terrible for them as a human being, you know, I'm trying to tell their story. So I kept writing. And Jonah actually said to me later, he said, you know, I never wanted to stop you because this is the kind of book I wanted to read when I was a teenager. But yes, I was standing there, and yes, it's awkward, and yes, you keep doing it anyhow.
I would love it if you could fill us in on how things are going at Huertos today, and where's Jonah? What's up with him?
Jonah, I think, has come to an interesting place. After all of that hurry and all of that impatience, he sort of looked around. He's 29 now, and he realized that when the previous generation of famous, successful chefs were his age, depending on which one you want to pick, they were either facing bankruptcy or heading to the emergency room or working for somebody else or not really knowing what they wanted to do, that he was pushing himself because everybody was pushing themselves. But now that he has a restaurant, maybe it's time to take a moment, look around, and figure out what the next move might be. I think he's not sure yet, but I think he's okay with being not sure. So I wanted to use those kinds of stories to say, here's the whole universe. Here's how everything has changed since right before social media. I wanted to give a sense of that context so that it didn't sound like one anecdotal story in the middle of nowhere.
Well, you did a great job, and I'm so glad that we had this opportunity to speak on Louisiana Eats about your brilliant book, Generation Chef. Thank you, Karen. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Poppy, thank you in return. It was a lot of fun.
Karen Stabiner, author of Generation Chef, Risking It All for a New American Dream. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll be taking you along to the Havana Jazz Festival with the one and only Preservation Hall Jazz Band.
I think what's most important about the old Havana, it's all of the work that's being done to preserve. It's the history of Cuba, counted through the buildings.
On Thursday, January 12th, Louisiana Eats is teaming up with French Market Coffee for the first in a series of celebrity chef dinners to benefit the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Join us for an evening of fun and fine dining as Brennan's executive chef, Slade Rushing, prepares a three-course meal paired with wines by Bin 428. To see the menu and buy tickets, visit my website, poppytooker.com. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau. And from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant, serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.